Welcome back to the RM Williams Outback Podcast. Great to have you here. This is Terry Cowley. I'm the host of the podcast and also the senior associate editor of RM Williams Outback magazine. We're very grateful to Ram Trucks for sponsoring this podcast. Conventional farming is not in Nambre's lexicon. Instead, the Tasmanian scientist turned sheep farmer uses a range of sustainable and ethical practices that led to her wool being snapped up by a high-end New York fashion label. Nambre joins us now. Hello, Nan.
Hello, Terry.
Tell me about Lemon Hill, your 444-hectare farm near Oatlands in Tasmania's Midlands.
So that is its formal name on the maps. Lemon, as it turns out, was a bush ranger who didn't have a very good reputation. And so I've never quite liked the name. And a few years ago, I changed the enterprise name to White Gum Wool, which is what I operate under now. It's quite a lovely property. It's about half and half sandstone and dolerite. Sort of more volcanic, shallower, but very fertile soils, and has a fair bit of native diversity in patches, although most of the farm has been sowed down over generations to introduce pastures.
Now, some time ago, Nan, you resolved never to hand feed your sheep again. You sold all your feed out equipment and opted to reduce stock numbers. Why did you do this?
So there's a short answer and then there's a long answer. I'll start with a short answer. The short answer is that I had come to realize that my animals need a lot of diversity in their diets to be as healthy as they can possibly be. And you just can't get that when you're hand feeding. So that just needed to go out the window. And that meant that I needed to maintain a far fewer number of sheep and mouths altogether eating on the property than I had in the past, so that there was plenty of growth and plenty of diversity in the landscape for the animals to forage on. The animals are naturally going to eat the diversity first. So if you don't have abundance in your system, you'll lose the biodiversity. And then when you lose the biodiversity, you lose a whole bunch of benefits that come with that.
And the long answer?
So the long answer is between 2006 and 2009, we had a driest, you know, lowest rainfall on record 3 years here in Tasmania. And I think it had a pretty severe impact on almost all of us. And I think we might be going into a similar cycle right now. We've had a very, very dry year this year, and it doesn't look like it's going to get much better anytime soon. Partway through that, I was hand feeding, so feeding in the paddock, and then I, taking the advice of some groups from South Australia, I set up what's called a drought lot, which is kind of like a temporary feed lot. So I was feeding the sheep their full ration. I had some lucerne hay and grain. And I ended up having to feed them in the drought lot for 8 months, which was very expensive, very labor intensive for me, not so much for the sheep, because all they did was sort of stand around. But what I realized coming out of that was that although they were fat, they had condition, they weren't healthy. And what I noticed particularly was the lambing season that I had shortly after they came out of the drought lot. I had the worst statistics for pretty much everything: prolapse uterus, lamb mortality, ewe mortality, and that I'd ever had. And so that made me sort of sit back on my heels and go, well, what just happened here? You know, because I did everything by the book in terms of the drought lot, the full ration. I gave them injections of vitamin A and D. I was sure everybody had enough food, but it wasn't the quality that they really needed to be healthy. And so after I got through that, and about the same time came across the research that showed that animals need that level of diversity in their diet, I vastly reduced the number of animals. So I took it from, I had cut it down into the drought lot, but before that I was running about 1,800 sheep. And since then I've sort of played around with the numbers, but I settled on about 600. So a third of the stocking rate I used to have, the highest stocking rate I've ever had. And all sorts of wonderful things started to happen. So among other things, I stopped having any problems with intestinal parasites. So since 2009, when I started making these changes, I have not needed to drench a sheep. I would if I needed to, but I haven't needed to. Lamb mortality and the interventions have basically dropped significantly. So almost no prolapsed uterus since then, which I'll just put a little marker there that that's also partly due to leaving their tails undocked, because the tails actually exercise an animal's pelvic floor. So that really helped with the prolapsed uterus issues as well. And they grow a lot more wool because they've got everything they need and more to eat. So they grow bigger. And so there's been a whole series of things that have resulted from that switch that have made it both better for the animals, better for the landscape. So the landscape isn't overgrazed. I can't overgraze it or I won't have that diversity. And better for me. It's a lot easier job than it used to be.
Of course, that's not all you've changed, and that's not all you do. I believe it's not uncommon for you to spend entire days in the paddock with your sheep.
Yes. So when I first started working on this diversity in the feed issue, I realized that because of the historical way my property had been farmed before I bought it in 2000, the diversity, where there's lots of species is in the native areas. So we've got sort of maybe five deliberately introduced paddock species plus whatever weeds there are, maybe 10 species in an introduced paddock. Whereas in the native bits, which are kind of around the edges and the rocky banks, places that couldn't be plowed in the past, there'd be hundreds of species. So the challenge I had was, how do I get my sheep to know where all those diverse patches are and what's in them and how to utilize them, because it's a learning process for them. And I couldn't just divide the property up into a whole bunch of little rotational grazing cells, because in any one grazing cell, there probably wasn't much diversity at all. And then in a few, there was a lot. So what I did instead, taking the advice of my mentor, Fred Provenza, who was responsible for doing the diversity in the forage research, when I took my problem to Fred, he said, well, have you thought about what they call active shepherding? And of course I hadn't, but in the French Alps, there's sort of generations of professional shepherds who manage flocks in the common areas of the Alps and summertime and move them through that landscape in a way that gives them optimal access to diversity. And so I got the book and started learning how to do it. And I spent the best part, I would say, it was probably about 5 years, 6 years that I did shepherding. I would shepherd every about 3 or 4 days a week, but all day long. So I take my backpack and my lunch and my flask and my dogs and my, I had a little thermal pad so that I could stretch out and have a nap when the sheep were sleeping in the middle of the day, and just stayed with them. I would move them very slowly so that they would be grazing through the landscape, but in the general direction of diversity. And then, you know, when it was time for me to go home, I'd leave them wherever they were, and they grazed away from there. So, yes, so I got to know the sheep really well. I got to know the property really well. I really do believe I could navigate around the property blindfolded after 6 years of doing that. But by the end of that 6 years, probably even before I stopped shepherding much, they were locally adapted. And that's actually a specific term in this whole set of concepts around how animals work in their environments. So it means that they actually know how to thrive as a collective in that environment. They know where shelter is. They know where water is. They know where the variations in feed, where the diversity that they need as a group and as individuals. They don't actually need to be told where to go. So I don't actively shepherd now. I do occasionally go out and spend some time with them, but I don't need to push them around the paddocks anymore.
Do you describe that knowledge as instinct?
There's two parts of it, distinguishable. So there's what's called an autonomic process, which means that that's like breathing. You don't have control over it, and that process allows an animal that's eaten something, a few hours later, if they don't feel quite right, they'll get what's called post-ingestive feedback. And they can connect that to the last thing they ate through the smell of what they ate. It's not really taste. It's actually really smell for mammals. And so with that feedback process, they can go, I had a little too much of that plant. I won't eat as much of that next time. I'll eat a bit less of it.
This is, of course, what we do as humans.
It is. And actually, left to their own devices, animals will, for the most part, will only, if they encounter a new plant, they will only eat a little bit. They won't eat a whole lot of it. They will eat a little bit, wait for the post-ingestive feedback, and then go, oh, okay, yeah, that's all right. Or, whoops, no, less of that. So that's if you want to talk about instinct, it's deeper than instinct. It's really like you don't have any choice. So what happens when you have food poisoning? I've had food poisoning. You get really sick and your body decides that the food, generally the most recent thing that you ate, was the cause. It might or might not have been, but your body will then become absolutely averse to that food. And you can't overcome that with your brain. You can't say, oh, no, it's okay, body, we'll eat oysters. The body's going, no, we are never eating oysters again. So that's kind of the extreme version of post-ingestive feedback. So that's the instinctive part, if you like. The learned part, which is every bit as important, is where are the plants in the system? What are the plants, how do they change? Because the things that are happening in that plant, those secondary compounds, they're things like tannins and alkaloids and terpenoids. They change their concentration in the plant depending on the season, the time of day, the time of year, how much moisture there is in the soil, et cetera. So a plant they eat one day, 2 months later, may have slightly different or even very different characteristics. So there's a real learning process. Where are they? What do the different plants do for me as an individual animal? Because not all animals are the same. And that process begins with mothers teaching their babies. So the primary learning process is mother to progeny. And then they also learn from their peers and from other sheep in the flock. So that learning process is really, really, really important.
I was going to say you obviously disrupt all these processes if you keep them in one paddock and feed them one type of food.
Well, that's right. And of course, what we normally do in conventional farming, wool growing, sheep raising, is we keep animals in year classes. And we do that for our own convenience, not because it's the best thing for the animals. So we would normally wean babies at 4 months, say, and then put them into a paddock, in which case they're wandering around like two-year-olds in a grocery store without a clue as to how to eat. So one of the very first things I had to do after I reduced the number of animals, I stopped weaning and allowed the babies to stay with their mothers forever, basically. They don't get weaned and they don't get separated except when I pulled the mothers off for joining. But then even when the mamas were lambing, their previous year babies were still part of that flock. Now I run all of my sheep except for the rams in one big flock year round. And I have sheep as young as 18 months now, and as old as 15 in that flock.
What you're doing obviously works, because most years you're delivering about 2,000 kilograms of 17 micron superfine wool.
It absolutely does work from a production standpoint, from an animal welfare standpoint, animal health standpoint. It's just, it's kind of like, why wouldn't everybody do this? Because it's so much easier and it leaves you with a, you know, a beautiful farm that is a place you want to be in, not a dust bowl, as happens in the kind of years that we're having now in Tassie. And it's just, you know, the sheep grow great wool. It's got good tensile strength. It's nothing not to like, except for the fact that you don't make enough money, because it was already a bit tricky making money when you're running three times this many sheep. So if you're running 30% of what you used to run, it's going to be really, really tough to make ends meet.
How have your practices been received by the local community?
Honestly, I think the people of my area, my farmers and the townsfolk, we get along fine. You know, there's no enmity or anything. But I would say that for the most part, I'm, you know, mad as a cut snake.
But I think the fact that you don't kill your sheep, or I don't know if that's the correct terminology, what terminology do you use? You don't send them away?
Well, it's kind of tricky, because no slaughter is all a negative sounding thing to me. So I tend to say that my sheep get to live out their natural lifetimes on the farm. That doesn't mean that I don't euthanize. I do when it's necessary. It's not always, you know, it's like with any animals, you have to kind of gauge the situation and let them, often they will let you know when they're ready to go. Some I have to euthanize because they get skin cancers that are not operable. So those sheep will be euthanized. So it's not like nobody gets killed, but nobody gets put on a transport truck. All my sheep are euthanized on the property, and mostly they're buried here as well.
Looking for Australia's best range of full-size pickup trucks? Then you want a Ram truck. Get into your local Ram dealer for the best selection of powerful, capable, and luxurious pickups all under one roof. With Australia's best range of full-size pickup trucks, Ram eats everything else for breakfast. Visit ramtrucks.com.au or see your Ram dealer today and get into a Hemi V8-powered Ram. Enough said.
Now, I'm sure our listeners have noticed by now that you have a slight accent, obviously not from Australia. Tell us a bit about your background and how you first came to Australia.
So, yes, you're absolutely right. It is an American, US accent, not a Canadian one. I'd like to think it's softened a bit since I've been here since 1995, off and on. Professionally, I was an oceanographer, physical oceanographer, which means I studied waves and currents and tides. And the last parts of my career before I moved to Australia had to do with looking at the role the oceans played in establishing patterns like El Nino and the Indian Ocean Dipole. But I had figured out, probably back in about the early 90s, that I didn't really want to go on doing research. I wanted to do something else, but I didn't know what. And so I came to Australia initially to visit some colleagues in Hobart at the CSIRO, and subsequently came back for a year on sabbatical, because I thought, I really fell in love with Tasmania. I just love the state. Geographically, it's just, you know, it's gorgeous. By then, I had been training border collies for a number of years to do sheepdog trials in the US. And I was kind of hooked on that. I thought, well, I can have a job that will pay my salary, and I can have my dogs and maybe have a little farm and, you know, make all of that work in Tasmania. So I got a job with CSIRO, which was a very high level administrative job. It took me all over the country, and it's pretty demanding, for 6 years. And in the middle of that, just to make my life a little more interesting and complicated, I bought this rundown farm. And so for the last 3 years that I worked for CSIRO, I was also sort of had one foot in the farming world, trying to figure out how to grow sheep.
You mentioned the dogs, but you also had a bit of a connection to the land growing up through your grandfather.
Actually, both sides. So both my parents grew up on the land during the Great Depression. And so I got really wonderful stories of animals and farming generally in those years. My mom's dad, but he had what they called the cow dog, Jack. And the story was that my grandfather could sit on the back porch of their farm and tell Jack, "Time to go get the cows, Jack." And Jack would go off and find the milking herd, wherever it was, bring them back, put them in the milking parlor, and, you know, basically wait for my grandfather to come in and milk them. And I just, to me, that was just magic. You know, it's like, how could Jack know how to do all of that all on his own? So I carry that with me and often felt like, oh, it'd be nice to become a farmer. But both my parents were adamant, no, you cannot make a living at farming. You have to have a profession. So I had this little internal tension going. And I think part of the lure of Tasmania was, whoa, I could do both. I can do a little bit of farming, but I'll still have a salary. So, you know, I won't go broke. And yeah, so that's where the dog stuff came from. And I also rode cow ponies. We go to my dad's, on my dad's side, it was a homestead ranch that my uncle ran. And so we'd go up there Christmas and summertime. And so I used to get to ride when they were rounding up cows and didn't have any sheep, only cattle on that property. It's just amazing. I mean, they know so much and I knew almost nothing. So my job was really just to try to stay stuck in the saddle and not, you know, not fall out.
Happy memories.
Yeah. Yeah, actually really very happy memories.
So we've talked a little bit about the financial challenges that come about with some of your practices, such as not sending the sheep to slaughter, having less sheep. You found a solution to that problem in part by value adding your wool and selling it under the label that you mentioned, white gum wool.
Yes. Yeah, so I had thought for some years before starting the yarn business that I would like to do something to move up the supply chain in some way. And that partly came from an experience I had fairly early on when I had gone to a wool sale when they were still having them here in Tassie in Launceston. And a broker bought one of my lines of wool for quite a lot more than the reserve. And I happened to be sitting next to the guy at lunch and I said, would you mind to tell me why you were willing to pay that much more for my line of wool? And he said, oh yeah, sure. He said, I had room in my container. And my jaw dropped. I just went, what? No, I'm turning myself into a pretzel trying to grow wool exactly the way you want it. You know, this long, this characteristic, this strong, you know, no whatevers. And you're telling me that I got a premium just because you had space left in your container. I found that very annoying. And so I held that, you know, kind of somewhere in the back of my brain. And then when I realized that to farm the way I wanted to farm, I was going to have to do something that allowed me to capture some of the margin up that supply chain. I came back to thinking, okay, well, what should I do? I actually was lucky enough to get an all expenses paid trip to Italy with a wool company, Schneider, who brought a group of Australian and New Zealand wool growers over to Italy to explore some ideas about different ways to market superfine wool. Merino wool more generally. And so I got to see what was involved in the processing, the scouring and then the combing and the spinning and the dyeing and everything in terms of the way the Italians process wool. So that was great in the sense that it was like a really good education, but it's really daunting because I think at that, before that, I was thinking, oh, well, maybe I should set up a little scouring plant and a little mill, you know, and da, 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 da. It's like, no way. No way. This is big business, intensive infrastructure investment. There was no way I was going to do that. So that made me then sort of go back and try and get a little more realistic about what I might do. And I settled on, somewhat serendipitously, but turned out to work really well for me, on the idea of having my fiber processed into hand knitting yarn and selling that to knitters. And so that's what I ended up doing. And I tried to get it all done in Australia and I couldn't. This was 2011 that I started that process. And we had a few processors left in Australia at that point, but they were going down like 10 pins at that point, or 9 pins, whatever the expression is here. So I just couldn't find anyone who was willing to spin my super fine 17 micron stuff into knitting yarn here. So I went to New Zealand and I found a great mill design spun and I'm still using them. They're still my supplier for yarn.
Another Tomorrow, the sustainable fashion label. Enlighten me about that connection and how it came to be and what it means.
So it's another one of those, I guess, somewhat serendipitous things. So much of what happens in the fiber world is word of mouth. Vanessa Barmani-Hala is the CEO and owner and everything else of Another Tomorrow, had found out about me through a cooperative called Fibershed in the US. And I think they must have found out about me through my blog. I'm really not quite sure. But Vanessa set herself a little job of trying to find a t-shirt that she could buy where she was able to tell transparency through the whole supply chain. She couldn't make it happen. She just felt that was not good enough and that she would work to figure out how to set up a company where there was that full transparency through the whole supply chain. So that meant actually going all the way back, in the case of wool as a fiber, to wool farms. And one of the things that she was determined was that things would be environmentally sustainable, that animal welfare practices would be the best possible, that any fair trade issues or salary issues in terms of people being paid fairly for their work, that all of that was in place and transparent. So when she found out about me letting my animals live out their natural lifetimes, she was really intrigued. So she came to visit.
So she is able to turn your wool into garments priced from $500 to $2,000. That is impressive.
Yeah, we're talking seriously high end. And it's all of her fibers are processed in Italy, and they're made into, I think they're mostly made into garments in Italy, but I wouldn't swear to that.
Do you still keep a small number of fleeces to sell to spinners and indie dyers?
I am. I don't do that specifically to sell them. So when I decided to let my sheep live out their natural lifetimes, one of the issues that I had been told and believed was that as the sheep aged, their quality of the wool would degrade, that it wouldn't be as good. And so I thought, well, I'd better know that as I start. It wasn't going to change my approach. I was still going to let them live, but I needed to know what was going to happen to the wool as animals aged. So I have about 25 sheep that have names out of my 600. And so I just decided to start measuring, doing the full suite of measurements that we would do on a bale of wool. I do on individual fleeces of individual animals, and I track them from year to year. So I started doing that in 2014. And so I've got 10 years of data on that. So each of those named sheep, I take a sample to test, and then I just keep the fleece, put the test results up with the fleece on my website, and spinners can buy them knowing what they're getting. I sell maybe 6 or 8 a year, and the others just go back into the next year's clip and just get blended in.
And you're finding that the wool production doesn't go down very much over time.
Hardly any. And I have to say that with a caveat, because of course, in that 10 years, the sheep that we're talking about have all had everything they need to eat. So they've had a really healthy life, and they continue. They've got their teeth. You know, they've got, as I said, they've got really good nutrition. So for the subset of animals of the world, of the sheep world, that live on my farm, there is essentially no degradation of quality. The only thing that I see is that in the last 2 or 3 years of a 15-year-old sheep's life, the length of the staple will get maybe 10% shorter. That's okay for me. That's not a problem. It blends in with the longer staples of the younger sheep. And remembering that in this flock of 600, I have maybe 5% who are 12 years and older, not 20%. So it's not like a huge component of the total clip. But I just thought it was very interesting. You know, the scientist side of me kind of went, okay, let's do this. Let's do it right. And when I looked at it, I was like, whoa, okay, there really is hardly any change. So from a wool quality and quantity perspective, there's no reason to kill animals at the age of 8.
So I have to ask you, what are some of their names?
Oh, okay. So the bottle lambs get names. So Alice she was special. She wasn't a bottle lamb. Annie and Emmy are named after Anne of Green Gables and Emily of New Moon because they were twins, but their mother died. So they were orphans. Felix was named after Felix Mendelssohn. Clara was named after Clara Schumann. Freddie was named after Frederick Chopin. Zach was named after Anzac Day, which is the day I found him. Let's see who else we've got. Oh, we've got Leonardo da Vinci, who is a friend of Vicky. So Vicky was a pet lamb, but she has boyfriends. She is still alive. And she has, I don't know, at least half a dozen boyfriends. They would hang out with her. She would hang out with me while we were shepherding. So they got names. And Leonardo's thing is he just loves machinery. He likes the Ute. He likes the Polaris side-by-side, anything like that. He comes up and has a real good look at it. So yeah, so there's a few of the names.
Very cute. Very cute. So you're aware that many farmers would dismiss your practices as only achievable at your small scale. But would you like to see many of these practices become more mainstream in future?
Well, so I'll address that question in its two parts. There is nothing inherent about the scale of what I'm doing. So the things that I do could be done just as easily at larger scale. And in fact, I think would make farming easier for those people who are responsible for the work. I don't accept the premise of scale. And I'm happy to have that discussion in detail with anybody who wants to have it. In terms of the adoption of the practices, I would like to see the industry as a whole take a more empathetic approach to the way we treat animals, the way we raise animals, and the way we end their lives. I've coined a term for this, which is instead of animal husbandry, animal wifery.
I like it.
And it's really about finding that empathy first for ourselves as human beings, because it's going to be hard to be empathetic to anything else out there if you don't feel empathy for yourself. Then to find that when you are thinking about your production system, you are bringing that feeling of empathy for all the things that depend on that production system. It's not just the production animals, it's the wildlife, it's the bugs in the soil, all of those things, that the whole system will work better if we bring that level of empathy and understanding to what we do. Having said that, I absolutely accept that the way the system works economically makes it very, very hard for people to do that. So think about my own case. As it happened, I had money in the bank when I decided to move up the supply chain. But for about 4 years, not only did I have no income from my wool, I had a whole bunch more costs slapped on top to get it processed, shipped, you know, the marketing stuff set up, building a market for it. So without some form of systemic support for people who might want to go down this track, but you know, no bank would have lent me that money, Terry. You know, not at the, talk about scale. At the scale I was working, no bank would have touched that in terms of a loan. So until we make it possible for people to transition from the way that they're farming now to a different way, even if they want to, they're not going to be able to. So I think that the industry as a whole, if there is a willingness to change, which I haven't completely seen yet, but if there were to be, there would have to be some pretty significant changes made in the way we operate as an industry.
I'm sure you're right about that. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, Nan.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate the chance to say things. It's been a great pleasure.
Nan's story by Kirsty McKenzie features in issue 154 of R.M. Williams Outback magazine. Thank you for being my guest, Nan.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for joining us here on the Outback Podcast. I hope to welcome you back in our next episode.
Now's the time to upgrade to a new Ram truck. With unrivaled Hemi V8 power and a max brake towing capacity of up to 4.5 tons. With quick delivery available right now, you can get behind the wheel of a new Ram faster than ever. Stocks are limited, so see your Ram dealer or visit ramtrucks.com.au today. Ram eats everything else for breakfast. Stock and delivery times vary by model and dealer.